Hi everyone, my name is Shona Lane. I'm Education Officer here at the Western Plains Cultural Centre.
Joining me today are Andrew, our manager.
Hi there.
Caroline, our assistant curator.
Hello.
Jess, our collections officer.
Hi.
And our guest speaker for today is Sandra Kingston from Macquarie Anglican Grammar School.
Hello.
Today we'll be focusing on Goya, who is currently in the project space in the gallery. This exhibition features an early edition of Los Caprichos, a set of 80 etchings first published in 1799. It was one of the most influential bodies of work in the history of Western art. Created at a time of social repression and economic crisis in Spain, Francisco de Goya set out to document the human condition and denounce social abuses, social backwardness, ignorance and intellectual oppression. To kick off our conversation, we're going to talk about the nature of his works and exactly what you'll see if you come into the project space in the gallery.
Los Caprichos was probably Goya's first sort of overtly political work, and it was designed to be a book. So the 80 etchings as we have them on display in the Cultural Centre would originally have been combined and bound into one book. And it was a way of getting kind of a political message through art out to the public so that you could reproduce it numerous times and disseminate it widely throughout Spain to get his message across. One of the kind of important things about the body of work is the fact that he combines numerous printmaking techniques into the sort of works that he's done. So we have etchings, which involves a plate being covered with a wax surface, and then the artist will draw his image into the wax, then place the plate in a vat of acid, which eats away where he's kind of carved into the wax. And from that, you can then take prints off that plate. He also includes a technique called intaglio, which involves on the wax surface sprinkling a fine dust of chemicals and metals that when the acid eats away at it, it leaves a very delicate shading across the print, which gives his work a real sense of mystery and depth, and there's an emotional quality to them that previously printmaking had been quite sort of very narrative and very simple in its design, but Goya really heightens the emotional content in his works with his combination of various techniques.
Thanks, Jess. Just in thinking about two things that Jess has mentioned, first of all, the fact that it was made to be disseminated, it actually wasn't widely accepted. Can we have a chat about that and why it was that it didn't go very far?
Well, I think that one of the things that, yeah, as Jess was pointing out, I mean, this is printmaking, so it's a very mechanical production, and we think of it bringing it out into the public. But really, when I look at these works, I see them as being very private. There's a delight in what he's done in this scandalous thing that you could take this book home and no one would know that you were looking at these quite over-the-top images, the sort of things that, if you could see my air quote marks, a proper person wouldn't be looking at. And I think that there's, not only is it mass-produced, but it's giving, there's a private life, whereas before, I suppose the private life of art was restricted to the very rich, those who could afford to have artworks in their parlour or in their stately rooms or wherever. Here you're now getting down to the middle class or something, in printing in general, being able to bring these books in, and they could be shared. So you could say, here's a book, take it home and have a look at it. It could be gone to a much broader place, and I think it could be a lot more confrontational.
I think that's one of the reasons that Goya is considered the first modern artist is the fact that he is creating art in a political environment. Spain's going through incredible turmoil politically after the French Revolution and Napoleon invading and different things. And he's actually creating a very personal vision of that experience. It's all about his imagination, his subconscious, his emotional experience of a massive national event. And yet he's giving that to other people to try and connect with them. So rather than kind of displaying images of the war on a grand kind of scale that everybody will relate to, he's using his own personal vision and understanding that people in the world, people in Spain, would probably have the same emotional response and be having the same nightmares and fears and concerns. So it's that change from looking at things as a collective to really starting to get personal visions being the way that you communicate a grand national event or a grand social change. And that's what makes Goya such a modern artist in that trying to communicate with a lot of people, but on a very personal, in a very personal way.
Thinking about the way that it's displayed now then, now that it's no longer a book and no longer so personal, what are the benefits of seeing it as we get to see it today in the gallery?
Well, I brought Year 11 and 12 students, and after studying it in the classroom and seeing one page at a time, they were able to put it together as a narrative, and they were able to read it on the wall rather than turning the pages. And I think for them, the images made a deeper connection because of their timelessness. I think that although his goblins and caricatures and the repetitive inclusion of animals as his characters, they were able to see that continuous, and they were able to put a deeper connection to his meaning and his intention behind his practice. So.
Did they get a sense that he was modern? Did they recognise him as modern?
I think when we talked about contemporary issues that we could interpret these works with, they then saw that other painters weren't doing that or other artists weren't doing that, and yes, then he was something very different to what was happening at the time. So
the kids can recognise the vices that he's picking out in his society at the time are definitely still prevalent in our own society, so there's definite connection they could make there once they're aware of, you know, what it is that he's satirising and critiquing in everyday life. And the next thing I wanted to think about was what shaped and influenced Goya's work. We've already talked about some of the things that he was picking up on, but these works were particularly dark for Goya, so I wanted to chat about what influenced the change in him, because there was a significant change to quite dark work from very light work in his early career. So can we chat about that and what influenced those changes?
Well, I mean, Goya, before making Los Caprichos, Goya was very successful, very well known as a court painter. He worked for the rulers of Spain to paint, you know, court paintings of the kings and the sort of lords and ladies of the Spanish court. And around 1780, 1790, he starts to go deaf, and that causes him to retreat in on himself, and he starts to pull away from society and kind of start to really focus on a kind of internal world that he has, because he's, through that loss of a sense, he becomes disconnected from the external world. And I think that retreat onto himself and that interest in his own experience of the world takes him off in that dark direction, because he starts to become conscious of his fears and his isolation in the world and the power that your imagination has when you've lost a sense. You start to become fearful, I suppose, of sort of the dark corners and dark recesses of the world. So I think that very personal experience of his, you know, losing a sense forces him to retreat from the sunshine, so to speak, and crawls back into a very insular hole, and which is why you start to get works like Los Caprichos and his series of paintings of insane asylums. He starts to seek out other people who are disconnected from the world.
And these works necessarily more successful than his early career ones?
Well, fortunately, unfortunately, it's a bit of a question of how we then look at his court paintings, because there's a lot of debate about whether he was actually making fun of the court of Spain, and it's only later that you kind of read that into it. But I think they are more successful simply for the reason that they are giving us an insight for the first time into somebody's subconscious and somebody's imagination and their fears and nightmares and the things that aren't tangible in the real world, which was not a subject that artists had ever kind of considered before. And it really does pave the way for modern art. You know, that real individual vision is something that we kind of really associate with art now, but that hadn't existed before Goya's time. So that's why we kind of look at these works as being so significant and so important.
See, that confuses me. That debate you mentioned about whether or not he was making a joke of the courtly paintings, because if you look, I think it's some of his work of King Carlos IV and his family. Yes. If you can find an uglier royal baby, I don't know that anyone could have looked at that and said, he's gorgeous. It's the hideous. The dog is better looking. I mean, he must have been, in a sense, that sort of almost going back to that Shakespearean jester, that
yes,
someone in the court who was given license to do this sort of thing by a king who didn't mind having it
well,
taken out.
Well, I don't know
that
he didn't mind. I think it was more that he was didn't quite get the joke, and he was being made fun of, and he was not aware of what was going on. He was.
But what do you, I mean, I can't imagine the scene where there's Goya saying, no, that is a beautiful boil on your nose. That's it's perfect. It's yellow like the sun. It's, you know, I just get this sense of seeing what he does. And the fact that the king actually took these artworks or took the book after the 3 days it had been on sale, and so Goya lost the bottle a bit, that the king, that he gave it to the king, that the king was in sense some sort of, was a patron. I mean, he was a patron, but in a, in a more particular sense, he was someone who was protecting this man from people who would be happy to do him harm.
I think there was a very unique relationship between Carlos and Goya, in the sense that they were, Carlos very much looked at Goya as someone friendly and helpful and supportive of him, but I don't know that Goya ever really reciprocated that level of trust and friendship. He was aware of the fact that this was a job and it was a commission. So I think Goya was well aware of what he was doing, but I think it would have been a brave person to stand up and, you know, to keep the emperor's wearing no clothes kind of thing, to point out what Goya was doing. So it's only with hindsight and with the, you know, radicalism of his art that we can look back and say, see, he was doing it from the very beginning.
Okay, just you mentioned a couple of things that made Goya the master that he's considered today. In terms of, you know, internalising things and presenting them to the public, what else do we think contributes to him being the master that he's considered today?
Well, with the students' responses as well, they were stimulated by imagination. They were trying to imagine what these little creatures were, how he was feeling as a person, what possessed him to do it. And there was a lovely quote we found, and we were talking about the darkness of his work. It said, Goya complained about a noise in his head. And the student's response to that was, well, when you lose your hearing, maybe you see more, or you internalise more. And maybe that was his subconscious talking to him. So I think the stimulation of imagination, I think that makes him successful.
And the perpetuity of his work, we're still talking about it sitting here today. We're still perplexed. We still can't quite pin it down. Is it caricature? Is it political satire? Is it the rantings of a soon-to-be madman? And there's been discussion over the centuries over Goya's intentions, and that continues. And there's the argument that rather than depicting specific figures in the political court of the time, he was laying out archetypes and creating a sort of template of social behaviour that continues to this day.
I think there's also, he's part of, you know, also much wider movement of artists and I think writers possibly earlier than this, who are turning away from those very dull images of what was acceptable to be written about. Mm-hmm. So you could write about man as being noble if man was a peasant, mm-hmm. if someone working on the farm, but you know, a man who was down a mine was not noble. A man who was mad was not noble. And he is, in a sense, he's going out after that. He's one of those early artists who actually do that. You know, earlier printmaker Hogarth does that, but does it in a much more, you know, sort of wham-bam fashion. It's much more confrontational. And, you know, it's got, there's writing and speech bubbles and all that, so it's a bit more cartoony to our eyes. And I think Goya sort of is at a slightly higher level, if we can use that sort of term. So that's why I think he's still there.
Mm. Mm. I think it's it really strongly connects to the impact it has on the viewer. It is confronting and it is disturbing and it makes you feel uncomfortable. And I think, you know, before that time, maybe art was appeasing people and making people feel good about themselves and presenting things that were things that we wanted to look at and appreciate and, you know, admire the beauty of what we were seeing, whereas Goya was putting something in front of us that really, you know, made you feel like you didn't necessarily want to keep looking at them. And I think that continues to have an impact today. Mm-hmm. The last thing we'll think about is the continued value of Goya today. Sandra, do you think there's significant value for students?
I think Goya's work is very valuable for students today, as it looks at the past artworks and makes that connection to modernism. And we also study other artists that have or show influences from Goya as well. So I think the students looking at this, it is a significant piece to look at, and I think it's very valuable as well.
I think that Goya, for some reason, particularly, I think also appeals to late adolescent, early adult people, because it is, you are in a period of your life where you're, everything is emotionally intense, and you know there's extreme highs and extreme lows, and that's what Goya's art is about. It's about the extremes of emotion. So I think as individuals, when you're going through trying to work out who you are as a person at that time of your life, and you see Goya's works, you're instantly kind of placated and made to feel better that actually sort of terrors and nightmares and extremes of emotional sort of reactions to things are legitimate. They're not just legitimate, they're worthy of going into art, and they're worthy of being celebrated as part of the kind of human experience. So I think, I know I personally, when I saw Goya in high school, it was sort of a revelation about how dark art could get and still be resonate with an enormous amount of people. So I think that's why, particularly for sort of students and in a contemporary society where we're very much about trying to kind of understand how human nature can kind of go into those dark places, Goya's work is always, it's always a ton of touchstone that we come back to.
Plus it's got farting in it.
Thanks for that, Andrew. We'll leave our conversation about Goya there. And now we'll move on to what's happening here at WPCC. Andrew.
Okay, well, as you know, April 25th is the most holy day in the Australian calendar, Anzac Day. So we'll be doing an Anzac Day breakfast after the dawn service. The week before that, I'm going to give a talk about Anzac Day on the myth of the Anzac. People around this, I know they're looking at me, this might be the last talk I ever give. So this could be the last time you hear me on a podcast where I've got all my teeth. I'm going to be looking at the role the myth has played in the Australian Army and in Australian society, and where it may have come from, and whether or not it's probably the healthiest myth that we can be using to help define our civilization. So that's going to be on Thursday, the 21st, here at the Western Plains Cultural Centre. Starts off at 1 o'clock. $8. That includes lunch and a small bag of rocks.
To throw at Andrew's on the lunchbox presentation.
Yes. Yes.
Now, Saturday saw the opening of the latest instalment at Regional Art Space. We had two artists from Orange, Heather Pike and Victoria Lavecchio, who revealed their work to us. They work with memory, family, using found objects, printmaking, oil painting. It's a beautiful meditative show, and I do recommend you come and see how these women's creative practices weave and their personal histories. And it's a very brave thing to take your practice from your studio and create an exhibition, and that's the purpose of the Regional Art Space, and to see the talent that we have in the Central West. And coming up in the next opening that we have at the Western Plains Cultural Centre is Jeff Minchin, who's going to be taking over the project space and the children's gallery. This is the latest instalment of Australia's Masters of Craft, which comes from Object Gallery. And Jeff Minchin is a master ceramicist who is based in South Australia. And I think his work will resonate really well here. He's very inspired by the Flinders Ranges, and I find his large-scale ceramic works bring outside in, and I think it will blend very well here in Dubbo. So that opens on the 16th of April at 2 p.m. So please come along.
And in collections, we're reaching a minor milestone for a project that we've been running here for almost 3.5 years now, which is a major deaccessioning program, which has seen the removal of almost 1,500 objects from the museum collection. So we are now at the beginning of our final stage, in which we're at the last end, in which some of the remaining objects will be going to auction in the next few weeks. Deaccessioning is a major collection management tool that is increasingly used by galleries and museums to make sure that their collection is as streamlined and refined and tailored as well as possible to the audience that it serves. So this deaccessioning program began in 2005. and we're finally seeing the end of it now.
Fantastic. All right, in education, I'm just getting prepared for Box of Tricks, Blast and Artwork, which are three programs that will see me venturing out into the far reaches of Western New South Wales, to schools, senior citizen homes, secondary and primary schools, taking our collections both from the museum and from the art gallery, and hopefully educating the kids and adults on the wonderful things that we have here in our collection. Okay, now we'll move on to what's happening elsewhere, and I'm going to pass to Andrew.
Okay, well, I don't know if it's connected to Goya. I don't think he instigated it, but it is, in a sense, we were talking earlier about sort of Goya's political impact and the sort of thing he had. And in the newspaper, it's just been revealed that Chinese artist and activist Ai Weiwei has been detained by the Chinese authorities for his, I suppose, his political artwork. And it sort of struck me as almost anachronistic in this day and age to be locking up an artist for what they're saying. Because I've never really thought that artworks in themselves have the ability to change the world. I know there's people already sort of nodding their heads in the way that this is going to turn into a shake very soon, but what I would say was that, I know we can go back to Goya's, from his Black Series, you know, the famous, is it May 4th?
May
4th of May, the shooting of the partisans, or the execution of the partisans. It was done years after the event, and really years after the war had been decided. Guernica by Picasso was done a lot more contemporaneously and did cause shock in art circles, but within art circles. You know, I don't know, I don't know that they were the ones, you know, people weren't flocking to join the Spanish Civil War because they'd seen that. You know, I would say that probably the most recent examples of truly meaningful political art probably come from the Soviet Union, and it would be, or you know, the Eastern Bloc, and it would be the government authorized, you know, those great posters, that great public art where you're using sculpture and you're using posters to get across a political message. I'm not sure in this day and age, except maybe for pop music and, you know, Bono's constant concerts for anything that he needs money for, really, and I, you know, sort of impact the public that much. And I'm just wondering what everyone else's response is. Is the age of the artist as a political activist, as a meaningful political activist, that can make a change, a radical change, is that something from the bygone era?
I don't think so. I think it depends upon the context of where they're doing it. I think overtly political art that's going to change the world in America or Western Europe is all but at an end, you know. But I think in more totalitarian countries, in, you know, Asia, in Africa, in South America, there still is a role that I think art can play, not necessarily in changing regimes and bringing down governments, but about highlighting to the world that there are citizens within their borders that are not supportive of the regime, that there is a democratic movement still happening, and that we may not be able to communicate that with you via the internet or via the newspapers or via literature, but we can tell you about it through our art. And I think that it's not necessarily the art that is the issue and the political, but the fact that it represents an attempt by people to communicate outside of their country. So that's probably where I think the political power of art is. And I think by using the reference of the Soviets, it highlights the fact that governments understand the power of art, and they understand the fact that it can communicate with people on a really subjective way and a really emotional way that isn't necessarily about telling them the rules that they must follow, but telling them the kind of political ideals that they should or shouldn't follow. And so it ingrains in people's consciousness a lot deeper than simple laws may do. So I think in that way, sort of the politics of art is still powerful. And also I think it's about the sort of people being able to express the fact that there is a certain kind of, for example, with Ai Weiwei, a Chinese mentality that we kind of understand as being the things that they value in their citizens and things like that, and that we in the West shouldn't make judgments about the entire country based upon those grand statements of what it means to be Chinese or whatever.
Well, I understand the what I mean is that it seems anachronistic of the Chinese authorities to do this, because they're, I mean, every government has problems with, you know, the American conservative side of politics has problems with Hollywood, who make what they think to be liberal movies. But they don't lock them up. They just marginalise them. And art is easy to marginalise. You can just say, oh, just nutters, you know, whatever. I mean, Goya, Kasich point, you know, probably correct in that case. But, you know, there's lots of ways that you can just say, oh, look, they're unimportant. And, you know, the work that Ai Weiwei does is not going to be seen by the vast majority of the Chinese citizenship. And it just seems to me really weird. But, you know, maybe harking back to the, as you said, governments understand what art can be, but it seems to me a massive overstatement or a massive overkill to be sort of arresting a man.
Trying to understand the motivations of the Chinese government in doing this is, you know, how long is a piece of string? You could talk about it forever.
I need to point out that this is Dubbo City Council has no official opinion on the Chinese government.
But also, it's happening in the part of a context in which the Middle East is in the state of revolution, and governments that have that of a similar government structure are cracking down on writers, artists, in order to prevent potential revolution or potential dissidents in China. But I also think that whatever the motivation of the Chinese government, stopping Ai Weiwei's art is not about the art that he may show the Chinese people. It has nothing to do with the community of China. It has to do with China, the increasing strength of dissident voices, of Chinese dissident voices in the West. That's what they're trying to shut down. And I agree, it's a ridiculous way of doing it, because, you know, the entire world knows where Ai Weiwei is and what he's doing and where he is. And so trying to sort of arrest him and shut down his studio is, you know, the horse has bolted. There's no point trying to do that. But they're not a logical government system, I don't think.
Yet again, Dubbo City Council has no... What? Speaking of the Middle East, though, when you see them burning the posters of leaders in the Middle East, I never know whether they're burning the person or just the fairly horrible painting that the poster represents. But I'd be interested in the schools. Do the students, do they see power in art, in the politics, or is it very personal?
Well, power in art and power is one of our Year 11 case studies. And we look at propaganda from the past wars, but we very rarely go into the contemporary side, because I think we don't see it as propaganda or a political activist anymore. It is just somebody's expression. But I think it's very interesting to hear that an artist is now threatening a government, and it seems too big to be true. It seems that this one little artist expressing himself has that much power over a government that they feel threatened by him. So I think when we look at it as a class, we look at how art can influence through expression, political or just emotional, not too sure.
What's it? I mean, we're getting Art Express opening, I think, on the 2nd of July, so it's only a couple of months away. And you can guarantee that there's political works in there.
There was a great one at the New South Wales Gallery I recently went to, where a girl had illustrated the 1950s Women's Guide to Being a Housewife, I think it was. Very, very funny. But that slight undermined political statement there about women's rights and things like that, coming from a 17, 18-year-old, was just fantastic. So, yes, I do look forward to the Art Express and their comment on how they are affected by it. I've got a Year 11 student at the moment looking at, we're doing environments, and she's looking at the effect on natural disasters on children. And again, it's maybe the war and the political statement is something that we don't look at. We look at the bigger pictures of things that is tangible, whereas the politics is sort of something that we may think that go above the children's heads, but it's actually infiltrating them.
All right. Okay, well, I think we'll leave our discussion there. Thank you, everyone, for joining us, in particular Sandra, for coming
in. Thank you.
Thank
you. My pleasure.
Thank you.